Again, it's our fifth annual Sunday Morning Magazine with Rodney Lear recommended summer reading list. For a complete list of all the books that we selected this morning, head to our Facebook page, Sunday Morning Magazine with Rodney Lear on Facebook. Head there now, like us there now. You can actually join the conversation there as well. We continue our look at some of the best books that we selected in our young adult category. Up next is Nick Stone, her riveting and revealing New York Times best-selling debut entitled Dear Martin, tackles race relations here in America and has captured every major literary award known to man. It's our pleasure to welcome Nick Stone to Sunday Morning Magazine.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Rodney.
Now, I understand that you lived in Israel for a few years. What took you there and what was that experience like for you? Because that's quite unique.
Yeah. So I was intensely evangelical when I was younger. And I went there initially because I really wanted to explore the land of the Bible and kind of go to these places and visit these sites where the Bible happened. While I was there the first time, I met a guy who just happened to be very attractive and also very smart and very kind. And I wound up marrying him. And so then I moved there. It was interesting. As you can see, I am clearly back in the United States. So that should tell you something.
Okay, so did you bring your husband back?
I did. I dragged him out of his homeland. I certainly did.
So how true is this, Nick? I understand that you had the chance to work with famed author Jodi Picoult, and eventually she became a mentor of yours. How true is that, and how did the two of you cross paths?
Yeah, so Jodi Picoult, she was working on a book. The book is called Small Great Things, and it was released in 2016. It's this book about, it's really about racism. It's about a nurse, an African-American nurse, who is barred from caring for a baby. She's an OB, she's a labor and delivery nurse, and she's barred from caring for the baby of a pair of white supremacists. And when she was doing the research, when Jodi was doing the research for this book, I was a senior at Spelman College, and Jodi was coming to Spelman to interview the president of our college at that time. I was doing an independent study in fiction because I was trying to get into writing. And I got invited to this meeting that she was going to be having at the president's house, and we just kind of clicked. I offered to, you know, help her with anything she needed when it came to the research process. And that's actually also how I got into this concept of, like, sensitivity reading, where, you know, you're writing outside your experience and you have somebody living the experience you're writing about. Read it to make sure it's accurate. She was the first person I ever did that for. And, yeah, we just really vibed, and she to this day is very, like, invested in me. I actually just read her newest book that comes out this fall, so everybody be on the lookout for that. It's really good.
All right, now let's talk about this. Now, one thing I found really interesting in the acknowledgments at the end of the book, you talk about how you had to cut half of the book. By this being your first novel, what was the editing process like for you, and what did you learn about yourself as a writer during that process?
It was a nightmare. Can I first say that? so my editor is a bit of a legend. She worked with the late Walter Dean Myers for like 20 years. Mm-hmm. So she's got quite the resume, and she knows what she's doing, Rodney. Like, and it took me, as this little baby author, kind of full of zeal, it took me a minute to come to an understanding of the fact that, like, she knew what she was talking about. So a lot of it being a nightmare was because of me. originally, the book was, it was double the length, as you just said, and there were, like, 8 points of view. It was just a lot more complex. But with that complexity and the other subplots, and there were just too many characters, with all of that, kind of the core of the novel got a little bit lost. So she helped me to streamline what the crux of the novel needed to be and really draw that out more. And what I learned about myself as a writer is that if I don't pay attention to what I'm doing, I can get into this, like, kind of show-offy thing where I'm just trying to show, where I do these, like, narrative acrobatics that are completely unnecessary. So she really helped me to see kind of the beauty of simplicity, and also the fact that, like, honestly, the shorter books, they're harder to write, but man, can they have quite the impact.
The book is brilliant, if you ask me.
I have
a 13-year-old son, so I couldn't wait to, you know, share it with him. You know, a lot of the things that you talk about in the book, but we'll talk about that in a second here. But first of all, tell us about the book. Tell us about the book, and how did you come up with this concept for the book, The Dr. King Connection?
Yeah, okay. Okay, so when Jordan Davis was killed in 2012, he's a young man killed in Jacksonville, Florida over the loud music. When he was killed, I had a five-month-old. Like, I had become a new mom to a little boy, and it was just this, like, wake-up call for me, you know, to have this black kid killed because he had his music turned up too loud and somebody didn't like it. Like, that was, it was just, it was very jarring. And then, like, the Black Lives Matter movement, the hashtag kicked off when George Zimmerman was acquitted, but the movement kicked off after the death of Michael Brown. So it's like boom, 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 back to back, you have all of these black kids being killed. And as this mother of a black boy, it's like I had to do something just to process. So when Black Lives Matter, the movement, really got going, I kept seeing people quote Dr. King in opposition to it. And that was something that just really got under my skin as a person who, like, I totally idolized him. Like, I have no problem admitting that. And to see people quote him in opposition to this nonviolent protest movement, because that's what Black Lives Matter is, it just didn't sit right with me. And so I decided that I really wanted to explore, like, you know, people use his teachings to kind of promote respectability politics these days. And I kind of wanted to be like, wait a minute, let's see, actually, if he were alive, let's see what happens when we apply some of these teachings. Like, if I were a 17-year-old boy and I were to try to take Dr. King's teachings and apply them to my own life, what would my experience look like? And that's kind of, that is where the kind of the genesis of the novel and where it came from. And it, the idea of the letters, honestly just comes from like my years and years of journaling. Like, journaling is definitely a method that I've used for a long time just to kind of process my own life and process things going on around me. So you just kind of had those little collisions of things, and there it is.
All right. And so the book is about 17-year-old Justice McAllister. Is that right?
That's correct. In the opening chapter of the book, we see Justice kind of on this rescue mission. His ex-girlfriend has been drinking and is trying to drive her car, and his goal is to prevent her from doing that and to drive her home in her own car himself, just so that he knows that she's gotten there safe. In the process of trying to get her into the car, a police officer pulls up, assumes that he is trying to carjack her, and arrest him on the spot without giving him a chance to explain anything. And that incident is what kind of triggers him to start this social experiment where he decides he's going to try to live like Dr. King and record his experiences in this journal in the form of letters. And as the novel goes on, you see him facing all kinds of things that I went through, even as a girl, as the token, if you will, because he's the token in his school. He's one of the tokens in his school. He's a token in a lot of his experiences. And you see his view of things shift as his eyes kind of open to the reality around him. And, yeah, it gets pretty heated. Things get a little testy at times. Mm-hmm. But I'm definitely proud of not only of the novel itself, but of, like, the response that it's gotten. Because I get a lot of emails and messages from kids who read it and love it. And, like, I get the messages from the white kids are like, yo, this is amazing. I had never thought of this like this. Now I feel like I have such a broader perspective. The messages from the black kids are like, yo, I've never seen myself in a book before. This is the first book I've ever finished. Thank you so much for writing it and for reflecting me. So it's been a good ride so far.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about, you know, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death. What do young people, what do they know about Dr. King? What are you hearing from young people?
They know the highlights, you know, like I go into these schools and that's actually one of the first questions I'll ask is like, what do y'all know about Dr. King? So they know that he was a civil rights leader. They know that he gave the I Have a Dream speech, that he won a Nobel Peace Prize, that he was a preacher. So you get all of the high points. But very few of them know kind of the less shiny pieces, like, you know, the fact that he was on the FBI's most watched list. You know, like people have, it seems like the further and further we get from the civil rights movement, the more his legacy honestly gets a bit sanitized. And it's unfortunate, but it's also something that I try to do my best to make sure that we're talking about, you know, the same way people oppose Black Lives Matter and get frustrated about kind of the unrest that's caused and the upheaval that's wrought by these protests and these marches. Like, it was the same during the civil rights movement. Actually, it was probably worse, you know, because there weren't the same, like, the protections weren't the same as they are now. So just trying to make sure that these kids know more than the highlights has been interesting. Interesting indeed.
So let me ask you this. You know, every year I do a recommended summer reading list. Of course, this book is going to make that list. It's on that list.
Thank you.
So, but one of the things that I struggled with, and I'll be honest with you, is at the beginning, this is my fifth year doing it. At the beginning, I would not choose a book. If it had profanity in it, it was like an ixnay on that book. I would move on. It's like, I didn't want to do that. But let's talk about the use of profanity, because, and I've come to a different realization now, but let's talk about the use of profanity. You know, some young adult authors, they stay away from it, but you decided to use it in your book. Why was that important for this particular story for you?
I just wanted it to read authentically. You know, kids cuss. They're the ones reading it. You know, they're the ones I wrote it for. Mm-hmm. I was dropping F-bombs in kindergarten, Rodney, like just being honest. So, and you know, it's what, this is one of those very fascinating quirks of American culture, because this is, it's not like this in other, and I've lived in Israel, I've visited other places. The idea of, quote, profanity, it just isn't that big of a deal in other places. And it's a very interesting thing to me, like this notion of very specific words that aren't slurs, like they're not overtly offensive to any particular group, but there's this idea of these very specific words that you shouldn't use because it's taboo, but like, of course, people use them anyway. And that's really what I wanted to reflect. I wanted to reflect the vocabulary of your slightly above average Black American teenager. And in order to do that accurately, I just, you know, this is how the kids I talk to, this is how they talk.
I had to evolve into that. I know that, you know, to be realistic for kids facing certain situations or just kids out talking amongst themselves, that's how they talk.
It is, exactly. And you'd be surprised at how much that impacts a kid's reading experience. I know there are a lot, you know, kids these days, they're just inundated with so much stuff, like so much, there's just so much stimuli everywhere. And so to get a kid to sit down with this object that just has a bunch of words printed on sheets of paper, honestly, that's not as appealing as watching TV. Like, even to me, I mean, of course, to me, I love to read, but, like, I can understand why, you know, based on how kids are growing up these days and what they're constantly surrounded by, it's not as easy to get them to pick up a book for entertainment or for pleasure as it was back when there was less for them to occupy themselves with. And they're also a lot more self-aware. Kids today are a lot more self-aware. They're a lot more easily influenced by their peers, and they're a lot more cognitive of their own agency. Like they're more aware of the fact that they do have power and that they can use that power to change their environment, if you will. And so they don't want to read books where they don't see themselves reflected. And I totally understand that. So by presenting them as they actually are, it's helpful to these kids who, you know, typically wouldn't even pick up a book. And I've heard that from them. You know, this is like direct from the mouths of babes, if you will. Like, they like seeing how they talk written down in a book because it validates them.
And in case you're just tuning in this morning, I'm proud to present our fifth annual Sunday Morning Magazine with Rodney Lear recommended summer reading list show. On the phone with me is Nick Stone. She is the author of the book Dear Martin. For more information about the show or a complete list of our recommended summer reading list, all you have to do is go to our Facebook page, Sunday Morning Magazine with Rodney Lear on Facebook. Head there now, like us there now. You can even join the conversation there as well. Now, Nick, this is your debut novel. It's a New York Times bestseller. It's much talked about. It's all the buzz in young adult literature. You have won major awards for this book. What has this all been like for you, and how are you taking it all in?
I'm really not, Rodney.
Okay.
To be honest, like I got two kids. My kids are 5 and a half and 1 and a half. Mm-hmm. I got a husband. I travel a lot. Like, so I'm just like head down, nose to the grindstone, focused on the work. Like, I'm just cruising. My calendar just rang. I have to go do a phone interview. Like, that's really where I'm at. Like, just kind of a day at a time. Not thinking much about it at all. Just kind of focused on the next thing. My next book is out in October, so we've already started the promotion for that. And
okay, so you opened up a can of worms. Tell me about what's next. What's next? Because you're already working on it.
It's done. Yeah, it's
wow.
Done. So the next book is it's called Odd One Out, and it is about questioning and teenage sexuality. So I think people will find, as the years progress and more books of mine kind of enter the world, I have this thing for, like, picking apart societal problems. And this one has to do with trying to figure out who you're attracted to. I was questioning in high school, but it's not something that I would have done openly or would have admitted to anybody, because it just, that's not something that was okay back then. Mm-hmm. But I encounter a lot of kids, because I do some mentoring, and I encounter a lot of kids who are trying to figure themselves out, but feel very alone in the process. And, like, I know for me as a youngster, not like I'm super old now, but, like, in my teen years, the idea of somebody else going through what I was going through was just hugely helpful. Especially when you're dealing with kind of isolated things where you feel isolated because you just don't know what to think or how to feel about something. So knowing that somebody else even was going through the struggle would have been helpful for me. So really, I kind of wrote this book for, like, my teen self, but it's about these three kids. It's a boy and two girls. It's written kind of in three chunks. It's like, I call it a trilogy of novellas. Mm. So you have these three kids going through this kind of upheaval in relationships, because the relationships are suddenly colliding with romantic feelings and, like, who likes who, what's going on. I'm excited about it. It's very different from Dear Martin, but it's also, I think when readers read it, they will be able to tell that it's also, like, me. Like, it's a very me novel. There's a lot of dialogue. They sound like teenagers. There's cussing. Those things are in the book, just like they were in Dear Martin. But it's just this very different topic, and these kids are going through different things.
Well, thank you so much. And as I mentioned earlier, the book is brilliant. There were times where, you know, they say there are books that you can't put down, but this was one I actually could put down. And the reason I was putting it down is because I had to think. I was thinking, that's deep.
Yes.
I had to put it down to kind of just take it all in and say, okay,
yes.
But I just could not wait to share it with my, my 13-year-old son. So we talked about a lot of things, and I think it's good for a dialogue opener for parents about
Thank
race.
You. That is music to my ears.
Yeah, yeah. So congratulations, and we're very proud to have it part of our recommended summer reading list. Thank you so much, Nick, for taking time to talk to us, and we look forward to the next book.
Of course, Rodney. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Nick.
All right.
We've been speaking to New York Times bestselling author Nick Stone. Well, that's it for our fifth annual Sunday Morning Magazine with Rodney Lear recommended summer reading list show. For a complete list and exclusive content that you can only find on our Facebook page, go to Sunday Morning Magazine with Rodney Lear on Facebook. Head there now, like us there now, and join the conversation there as well. Well, that's it for this edition of Sunday Morning Magazine. I'm Rodney Lear. Until next week, be encouraged.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.